Come on in, come on in. We're going to be talking about this Jackson Pollock work right here. Everyone. So I want to begin by sort of setting up some specific conditions about modernism, particularly modernist painting. And these were really sort of forcefully argued by a very prominent art critic by the name of Clement Greenberg. I'll talk a bit about his ideas in just a moment, but I just want to begin by looking at this piece. This is, of course, a painting by the very famous abstract expressionist Jackson Pollock. Pollock created this really right around the height of his fame. He, of course, as a young artist, had trained and worked with David Siqueiros, perhaps most prominently Thomas Hart Benton, and had been sort of part of the social realist movement and also part of the Federal Arts Project as well during the Depression. He later, so his early work is very social realist in nature, right? Very sort of narrative, very driven by depictions of contemporary American life and culture, very figurative. As he matured throughout the 1940s, he sort of shifted to, interestingly, a highly abstract, a very articulate cubist and also surrealist, kind of very symbolically laden style and approach. Also very deeply influenced by Native American art, particularly the palette and the sort of the symbolism, if you will. but it was right around 1946 that he shifted to what he's most famous for now, right? The famous drip technique, like we see here, which itself was sort of loosely related to surrealist automatic drawing techniques. It was something that he and a lot of abstract expressionists were influenced by and interested in. Just a bit more about sort of the historical condition for him that this painting was made in. He had been showing in a number of very prominent galleries in New York at the time. His work was getting noticed. Clement Greenberg, a name we'll bring up again and again, as an art critic, had begun to pick up and respond favorably to his work as it was shown, particularly at the Betty Parsons Gallery and also Peggy Guggenheim's Art of the Century Gallery. And then I think most prominently was in 1949, he had a really big article written about him in Life magazine, titled, "Jackson Pollock, Is He America's Greatest Living Painter?" Question mark, right? And that gives a little bit of a sense of the public's wariness of this new abstract expressionist approach. But he was getting known for these sort of drip paintings. He also, in 49, had photographer and filmmaker Hans Nemeth come out to the farmhouse / studio in kind of upper Long Island that he and his wife Lee Krasner sort of owned and worked in. I mention all this because Hans Nemeth will come up again in just a moment. But let's first look at this painting and begin to sort of understand what made him so prominently a painter that someone like Clement Greenberg would respond to. He's most known for sort of the physicality of the type of work that he did, right? Famously, he laid his canvases, the support that the paint would go onto the floor, right? Very famous photos of him, moving all the way around, even stepping onto the canvas and like dripping paint on it, right? And there is a sense often there was a response of, well, gosh, I mean, anyone can drip paint, right? But when you look at a painting like this, you see that he was very interested in complete control of the type of paintings that he did. Look how masterfully this painting is composed, right? There is this delicate sort of balanced composition between all these sort of thick black drips that are beautifully textured up here at the top. Another patch right here, some lines right over here as well. The aspect of the sort of silver paint right through there as well. When you look at it, you see it. If you just sort of squint and look at the dark and the light areas, you'll see it's fairly well balanced. Asymmetrically, right? It tends to tilt a little this way, but this patch and that patch tend to sort of bring it just a little bit back towards the right, right? But I think what's interesting is look at the way that even though we see all these swirls, right? Look at the constant repetition of line, 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 right? There's this kind of angled composition that he works upward. He's very carefully controlling this. It's not just laying it down and just splashing paint. I mean, he's looking at how these are composed. Interestingly, I was just reading 2 days ago, MoMA in New York had been taking one of his early masterpieces and has been spending, I think, 2 years conserving it, cleaning it up and everything. And they realized through this long conservation process that some of the paint drips actually ran down. And that was because as he was working towards the end, he would take it from the floor and put it back on the wall and sort of step back to get a sense of the full composition, right? That again tells that he's very interested in kind of the control that he can get out of this. It's not just slapdash or haphazard. It's the type of gestural mark that he's making that, in some ways, the term abstract expressionism comes from, right? The idea of a highly abstracted painting, really non-figurative painting. But the kind of gestural mark gives a sense of kind of expressionist emotionality, right? It also led a critic, Harold Rosenberg, to describe this and other works as action paintings, which is where that term came from and associated with painters like Pollock. But the reason I want to begin here is because what I find fascinating is, look at the title, right? Everything about this mimics most of Pollock's work, and he usually titled his work just with a number, right? And I found in at least one source, this at one point was called number 1037, but here it's called collage number one. Now, what makes this a collage? It's the pebbles, right? You may not have even noticed, there are all these pebbles, and look at how carefully those pebbles are placed on the surface. They're not placed in any of the white areas, they're placed within the painted shapes. Those pebbles, to me, are fascinating for two reasons. One is because they're very carefully placed on there, and to a certain degree, they create sort of a visual mimicking of the dots of black paint in the upper left, right? They also break up some of the flatness of those blotches and those painted areas. But also, it's because why pebbles that adhere to the surface? They sort of stick out, right? It's a relief effect. And I can't help but think that those pebbles are placed there to some degree as a reference to the ideas of Clement Greenberg. Let me explain why, because I know that makes no sense in the moment. But the reason why is because Clement Greenberg was an art critic who got his start writing for the Partisan Review back in the 1930s. And he had very forceful ideas about what modernist art should be. Very early on, he sort of attached a lot of this to sort of Marxist ideology. And then by the time the 1950s rolled around and the Red Scare began, that kind of faded away from his work, right? And increasingly, he talked more and more about how modernist art should be, in his own mind, pure. And what he meant by pure was that for him, modernism should not be anything that is not related to the intrinsic properties of the medium and the process itself. So, for instance, he hated paintings that had imagery in it, recognizable imagery. He hated paintings that had an illusion of space. He hated paintings that had narrative in it. Because to him, all of that's not related to what painting is. What is painting? It's paint on a flat surface. So what should a painting be? Something that relates to flatness. And in particular, he liked paintings that evoked the perimeter of the composition, right? The edges. This is what he talked about again and again in his writings. In 1955, for example, in one particularly sort of important essay, he wrote and described what he called the law of modernism. And what he said was, quote, "This law is one that applies to almost all art that remains truly alive in our time," meaning modernist art, "that the conventions not essential to the viability of a medium be discarded as soon as they are recognized." And so for him, what that meant was, it's fine if a painter is working through ideas and they're like, oh, I'm going to paint this portrait. But as soon as they recognize that that portrait in that painting is not related to the intrinsic properties of paint, they should never do it again. Just get rid of it, right? And work towards this kind of very pure, what we call formalist practice of painting. And by formalism, what we mean, of course, is paint that is simply relegated to the intrinsic properties of paint. So line, shape, color, the flatness of the support that it's painted upon, all of that was what was deeply important to him about what modernist painting should be. He even regarded these types of things that he thought should be discarded in a very early essay as kitsch, right? It's not truly modernist painting because it's just... it's kitschy. It's presenting something else. You know, he equated paintings that had a narrative in them to stories, to literature. You know, you can do the same thing in a written text. What makes it painting? This is what, for him, made Pollock such an intriguing painter, was Pollock, through that physical gestural act, was very much about almost pure formalism, right? He's not interested in painting something. He's interested in laying support on the floor and composing and moving paint through this sort of intricate dance around it. That's what he wanted to do. And that's what, to him, made, or to Greenberg, what made Pollock so compelling. But then look at these pebbles. They do not refer to flatness, right? It's not the first time he had played with this. When Hans Nemeth, the filmmaker and photographer, came out to his house to film him at work, they did this really interesting thing, you can find it online, where Pollock constructed for him sort of a riser with a glass surface. And Nemeth laid under it with a camera looking up and filmed Pollock at work on the glass. And if you watch the footage, what's fascinating is he doesn't begin with paint. It's the first time he'd worked on glass. He takes raw material. He takes sand, he takes pebbles, he takes metal and plastic mesh, and he moves it around that glass. He's composing with these prefabricated objects. Then he applies the paint to it. And I think what's interesting about that is that the paint becomes secondary. It layers over all of the materials, right? Here, the pebbles are adhered last. And I can't help but think that's got to be somehow a reference to Clement Greenberg, right? It's his way of saying, yeah, Greenberg may espouse this sort of flatness, but these pebbles are an intricate part of this composition. And when Greenberg wrote about, say, collage, he did a very famous essay about early Cubist collage. One of the things he said about collage work was when you begin adhering things to the surface, it does two things simultaneously. It both acknowledges and reinforces the flatness of that support, and then immediately destroys it. Right? Because anything that references the flatness, like the pebbles here, we think, oh, it's on a flat support. But then because they have a bit of protrusion, a bit of relief to them, you no longer read it as just flat, right? Now everything on that becomes sort of bumpy and textured with those pebbles on there. So I think there's something really intriguing about the type of perhaps comment, and I don't know what Greenberg would have said about the incorporation of pebbles here, but it seems to be this kind of commentary on flatness itself, as Greenberg very forcefully argued for it again and again in his writings. And so this is partly why I've chosen relief as a kind of common thread here, because relief is antithetical to what Greenberg promoted. Right, what he often wrote about was, you know, a painting, for example, like the Rothko behind you, is a beautiful kind of eloquent comment about the support as the basis, the way that Rothko lets those colors kind of be absorbed in the raw canvas. That's very much about kind of painting as flatness and kind of pure, pristine, modernist painting. And yet here we have Pollock coming afterwards, just kind of adding these pebbles to it, right? In a way that really adds sort of a really dynamic kind of texture and relief effect to it, but it's no longer about flatness. So let's move on to the next room and look at our next piece and kind of continue our discussion about this.
Pollock's way of being difficult?
Well, that's what I can't say for sure, but I do wonder if it's kind of maybe him, and this is pure speculation, snubbing his nose a bit at Greenberg, right? Like, Greenberg goes on and on about, you know, flatness. We're going to walk to the still over here about flatness, and I kind of wonder, you know, but again, it's not the first time he had done it, so that's why I offer that kind of historical setup, is maybe it was just in his mind as he was working. Like, he had begun working with material, and it was just something that had become part of his process at the moment. So I can't say for sure, but... So, in continuing with Greenberg here and the abstract expressionists, I want to turn out to this amazing Clifford Still painting from 1956, so 5 years after Pollock painted the collage one that we just saw. And we must remember that Greenberg, in talking about his sort of formalist principles, if you will, were not formulated as only a response to the emergence of the abstract expressionists, right? I mean, I think one impulse we often have is that it was Greenberg looking at the type of work that painters like Pollock and Still and Motherwell and Franz Kline and others were doing and saying, well, they're doing this, so I'm going to make a sort of conclusion that this kind of pure modernism is what is the game of the day, if you will, right? Instead, I mean, he's writing about art historical early modernists and talking about how, you know, these types of formalist principles, flatness and support and the edges of a picture and the composition are all very, very critical to modernism. modernism itself, right? What he's doing is he's basically trying to define, in a very late stage of modernist practice, what modernist visuality is. It also, and I mean, just to call a spade, it was also important because the type of ideas that Greenberg is writing about and favorably reviewing artists like Clifford Still and Jackson Pollock also meant that their paintings sold better, right? So it was this kind of, you know, to a certain degree, sort of, you know, self-serving machine to a certain degree, right? The more that Pollock wrote, or the more that Greenberg wrote about it, the more that it helped artists like Pollock and Still. Having said that, I like to talk about Still, though, because while Pollock's words carried weight, I think Still is a fascinating example of, to some degree, this difficult relationship that artists are having with this concept of flatness, right? When you look at this painting by Still, this is called 1956 J Number 1 Untitled, from, of course, 1956. What we have is a painting that's very common to sort of Still's work at this time, very sort of mature in his career. Like Pollock, he had also began as an artist who painted very figuratively, had kind of a social realist a bent to his early work, and then slowly progressed more towards more heightened abstraction in his work until he got to work like this that is purely abstract. It's purely non-objective. It's purely non-figurative, right? It's not meant to represent anything except the shapes, the colors, the careful modulation and composition. What we have, though, is just an amazing painting in which there is this kind of balance of elements here as well. It's dominated by this sort of mustard sort of yellow. And then there is this sort of patch of kind of, you know, almost ivory, a kind of off-white here towards the bottom, and then this patch of black here with hints of red and orange and more yellow over here. And again, if you look, I mean, it's very carefully balanced, right? That dominant yellow is sort of asymmetrically balanced with the black down here. It's very heavy sort of visual weight down here at the bottom. But I think what's interesting is when you just look at how carefully he's not only painting it, but also there is, I think, just this beautiful hint, this beautiful sort of not exactly mirroring, but a sort of reflection of the contours of these jagged shapes. Just look very carefully at the way, for example, this patch of red here, the upper part of the contour of that shape mimics very slightly the upper patch of white right there. Or over here, where the dip down of this black shape as it comes back up mimics kind of the contour just above it, right? It's not a perfect, it's not like puzzle pieces you can lock together, but there's just a little bit of a mirroring there in a way that it makes everything feel very, as if every aspect of this belongs, right? It's meant to be completely enclosed here by the painting. There are aspects, of course, that fit with Greenberg's theories, right? Notably, what I love is just this tiny little patch of blue over here on the far left, right? Now, that is there, and it may not immediately jump out at you, but when you see it, you can't unsee it, right? It's like when you see something out in the world that you can know, you know, if it looks like a shape that there's a face in the floor over here. You can never not see that face again, right? Same kind of thing. That blue is there, though, as well, because like Greenberg talked about, it references the far left edge of the canvas, of the support. And so by doing that, what Greenberg would have loved, he never said this, but I'm extrapolating for him, what he would have loved about this painting was that by referencing the edge, then talks about the support as a kind of physical flat thing that he's painting not just on, but he's painting as part of, right? It's part of his understanding of the composition that he's doing. But there is something else as well that I just love about this to kind of extend the relief metaphor, right? It looks like a very flat painting. But look at the very kind of careful edging, particularly in the upper left there where the kind of mustard yellow comes down before it blends into that sort of peach. There is just that little hint of the darker kind of ochre that we see over there on the far left. And that gives it just a little bit of almost sort of overlapping, right? It's a very shallow aspect of depth. But I tend to read these shapes, and there's no reason to do this because it's certainly not what Still meant. But I tend to read these shapes as almost like sort of scabrous, you know, like it's scabs or it's wood grain. I also tend to think of it as almost sort of topographical map is, when you think of a topographic map, you think of a kind of linear representation of highs and lows in the environment. Now again, these are associations I'm making with it, right? And it's part of the nature of wanting, even on a very flat formalist painting like this, to ascribe some sense of depth, that there is a forefront and a background. And that's hinted definitely by just the elements right here in which the unprimed canvas shows through. It's a minor thing, but it's there because it very clearly tells us that there is a support, a back to this, right? And it's unprimed canvas. And instead of painting over all of it, still lets just a little bit of it come through. So we know the black paint is in front of something, and the unprimed canvas is behind it. Now again, that's minor, but it's part of the problem that more and more artists had with Greenberg's principles, that nothing can ever be truly flat. There's always going to be some sort of aspect of layering, right? And this is one thing that certainly, still and later formalist painters had to sort of contend with. Having said that, I also like to talk about still, because even despite Clement Greenberg's prominence and his dominance, really, about who he promoted, how he talked about such work, still was somebody who was brilliant and incredibly prickly, and he hated other people talking about his work. There's a fascinating letter in the American Art Archive at the Smithsonian, in which Still wrote it to Clement Greenberg out of the blue after Greenberg wrote this very long essay called American Type Painting, in which he talked about his concept of modernism and formalism, and he talked about Jackson Pollock, and he talked about Clifford Still and a number of abstract expressionists. And he wrote very positively about Still. So Still wrote him a letter, and he begins with, "Thank you so much for saying such nice things about me." And then he ends the letter with, "Please, in the future, check with me before you or anybody else tries to define my work." Right? I mean, this is a person who was mistrustful of institutions. He very famously, just purely anecdotally, sent a pair of rubber underpants to a critic who wrote poorly about his work with a note that said, "I hope this helps disguise your Sunday afflictions," meaning sort of the reviews that she wrote. He was somebody who just, he would not let anybody else speak for his work. And part of that was this, to some degree, part of the reason he was not entirely upset at Greenberg was because, like Greenberg, he felt that the work should speak for itself, right? That you didn't need to interpret it. You could just stand in front of it, this very large, very wonderful piece, and just sort of take it in and understand it on a purely formal level. But he also, and I just like to say this, it's not that he didn't have some other sort of associations with it. I mean, very famously, he wrote a letter to Betty Parsons, the gallery owner and sort of art promoter in 1949, in which he sort of evokes existential qualities to these types of paintings. He described his paintings as evoking, quote, "life and death merging in fearful union." I mean, that's big ideas, right? And I think what's interesting about that is, even though he was the one that would want to talk about this, not so boldly, but it's very clear that he ascribed other kind of very deep-seated emotional qualities to these paintings that go beyond just colors and shapes on a surface. So, I present that by way of just sort of beginning to indicate that even though Greenberg was very specific about his ideas, even the artists that he promoted that seemed to be most aligned with his ideas still gave bigger ideas to the types of work that this was. It's natural, right? We as humans, we as critics, sometimes even want to do this. And I stay that there because we're going to move on to one more work. We have two more, but one more just down the hall. And they're going to talk about some of the reaction against Greenberg that begins to brew in the 1950s and 1960s. So let's move on over there. Excuse me. Hi, got your thing back. How are you guys doing? Sorry, yeah, we're going to move away from the painting a bit. Sorry, thank you. Hi. Oh, wait, I did this wrong. Sorry, let's go this way. My bad. Mm-hmm. Oh, good. Okay. I've been talking a lot, probably too much, about these ideas and the position that someone like Clement Greenberg had in defining and sort of qualifying what constituted modernism, right? And in particular, modernist painting. And I should point out that to him, to a certain degree, it was specific to the medium, right? If an artist worked in three dimensions, which he wrote about, then it shouldn't be flat. You know, it should be three-dimensional. I mean, he was open-minded enough to sort of see that it had to vary based upon the medium and the practice. But that's why I wanted to talk about relief, because relief is one of those interesting things, even as a sculptural practice, that is neither in both 2D and 3D, right? It's intrinsically impure. Because it's not fully three-dimensional, and it's not fully two-dimensional. And the fact that, again, Pollock is putting pebbles on his painting seems to speak a little bit to the inconsistencies that can rise when you try to put your foot down and draw a line in the sand saying, this is modernist and this isn't. And so what begins to happen, as often happens with somebody who's very, very particular and forceful about their views and has a lot of influence, is that there tends to be a reaction to it. And so what happens to a certain degree is this shift from modernism to thinking outside modernism. What we later, much later, in the 1980s would begin to refer to as postmodernism, begins to sort of creep into artistic practice going all the way back to the 1950s and 60s and on. It really picks up speed in the 60s and 70s. With a lot of practices that seem to deny Greenberg's principles. One place we see this emerging, of course, is in Europe. And Europe, after World War II, is, of course, in a very different state than America after World War II, right? America had very little devastation on its shores. The economy picked up very briskly after World War II. And Europe, however, was in recovery mode. I mean, they were literally rebuilding. They were trying to get the economy back in shape. And one of the big shifts that occurs is that the center of the art world, the locus of the art world, moves from Paris to New York. That was part of the prominence of abstract expressionism as a movement, a loosely affiliated movement in New York in the 1950s. It was the first time that America took the mantle of avant-garde modernist practice and kind of ran with it. And what's interesting is when an artist like this artist here, Jacques Viegle, came to Paris in 1949 after studying in Nantes for architecture and sculpture, he came to Paris, and Paris was dominated by young artists doing formalist abstract work like the abstract expressionists. And he was a bit put off by this. And part of the reason was the ideology under which he practiced. He later would become affiliated with movements, one in particular called the New Realists, which I'll talk more about in a moment. He's also sort of loose affiliations with kind of late, and affiliations, I'm just saying, like, this was sort of the zeitgeist at the time. Late Surrealism, as it sort of tried to renew itself in Paris after World War II. The Situationists as well. And what a lot of these movements and kind of the ideology had in common was looking at everyday average life and activity. Right, it was looking at the world around them and saying, this is what art should reflect and replicate. Now note, that is completely opposite to what Greenberg is talking about, right? For him, painting is pure. It should be artists in a studio working with paint and support, and it should reference nothing outside of that. These artists and these thinkers wanted to do that. And as well, what begins to happen, as we'll see in a moment, is Viegle and others like him really begin to foreshadow, they're not influenced by because it comes later, but foreshadow critical French philosophers and writers and thinkers working in the late 50s and 1960s who are writing in very specific ways and with specific ideas that will influence the same idea of the everyday and reflecting the world around us. So here is Jacques Viegle's Let me just give a bit of background real quick about him. So again, he comes to Paris in 1949. He's very young. He's kind of put off by all the abstract painting, kind of the mimicry of New York artists that's going on. He referred to it as anecdote, actually. You know, something that really is just sort of meaningless. It's purely on the side of meaning. And what he meant, for him, what meaning was the real human activity around him. So he and a fellow artist by the name of Raymond Haines began to go out around Paris, and one of the things that they began to fascinate them were all these torn posters they would see up around Paris. And what fascinated each of them was the way that these posters were not just visually striking, but they're documents, they're records of human activity, right? There was a sense of, they didn't tear these, right? They were found this way, ostensibly. These are just average anonymous people. It's why he called these lacerae anonyme, right? The anonymous lacerations of average people over the course of who knows how many days, weeks, months, years, would just begin tearing at these posters just as they walked to work or walked, you know, to the bus or train stop or just because they were bored. And what he loved about this was that he described it as sort of the antidote to propaganda, right? Most of the posters were advertisements. They were things to sell a product to people. Here, the dominant poster that we see with this green grass and this kind of bright patch of yellow along the bottom, and this text, c'est normal, c'est normand, and then the norm and is cut off here, was a tagline for a cheese. I mean, it was just basically selling cheese, you know? And what he loved was that as people tore these, it was a very subtle but also very kind of forceful way of kind of responding to all this advertising. You know, not that everybody who tore these hated advertising. It may have just been somebody else tore it, so I'll do it too, right? We've all done the thing where you're in a dentist's office and you're going through the magazine and somebody drew a mustache and beard, say on Brad Pitt, and you're like, I'll do it too, why not? You know, there is a bit of maybe just sort of human mimicry going on there, but what he loved about this was that it was the human effort that this replicated. And so what he would do is he would very painstakingly take these off of the wall, be it a temporary fence put up to disguise a construction project, be it whatever, very carefully take them off and reconstruct them back in his studio. And so that's what you see, right? In many ways, and what Viegla often talked about, was that his work is not about him as an artist. It's about the anonymous people who basically made this. He's like, if I had my way, I wouldn't even sign it. It would just be named after all the anonymous people who made this, right? This correlates with kind of the early positioning that he was in of a group called the New Realists. This was sort of written about by a gallery owner and a writer by the name of Pierre Rustini. And in a 1960s sort of essay about this new movement, it also included artists you may have heard of, like Yves Klein, which may seem surprising, but one of the things that Rustini wrote about, and he's referring, of course, to all their practices, was he said, quote, or the group should be about, quote, sociological reality in its entirety, the common good of all human activity, the great republic of our social exchanges, our commerce in society, which is called to appear. Note, all of that is referenced in a work like this, right? It is about the human effort. It's about the commerce and activity that they see in the world around them every day. And I think most importantly, there was this kind of underpinning of sociology, right? It's artist as sort of sociological scavenger, you know, somebody who's just looking at society as it was. For Viegla, this is just basically a document of, you know, contemporary life. And so why shouldn't that be considered a work of art? Now, when you look at it, I mean, and this is where some of the conceit comes in, right? It is a very visually striking piece. You know, we have just this beautiful kind of rippled, you know, sort of effect of the reconstituted posters. We have, I love this, and this is in no way intentional, but the way that the tears, particularly this one here, kind of mimic the shapes on Clifford Still's painting, right? And a lot of these early pieces were compared to formalist modernist paintings, right? There was a sense of, well, it's also highly abstract, but it's not. It has text, right? And text refers to real things, to language, to communication. That's something that Greenberg would have just turned his nose at. You know, there's no reason for text in a work like this. I also love it because going back to this idea of relief, note that it is almost like an excavation, right? As people tore away these fragments, it's not just that new shapes are made, they are recessed, right? They go deeper and deeper, almost as if we're sort of chipping away at dirt and we find some sort of artifact. We don't know what the underlying posters were. Not enough has been torn away. In some examples, Viegla does, there is enough torn away where you can see some of the underlying imagery or some of the underlying text and know what was underneath. Here we don't have that, but it is still an amazingly striking work of art. Now, I say the conceit because, of course, there is the idea that as much as Viegla wants to say, I'm not the artist, right? I just found this and I put it up here because it's striking. And he would often try and find works, I don't think this one quite fits into that, but try and find works in which the text through the tears has been modified in such a way that it becomes sort of punny. You know, there's a sense of sort of humor there that tends to be lost on non-French speakers and things like that. Actually came up in an interview. But he is still deciding how much of the poster should be determined, right? He's the one going out in the world and saying, I want this fragment, you know, not that fragment. That fragment there, yeah, that's awful. This one, though, is great. There is some choice built into this, and we have to recognize that, right? As much as he wants to step back and give all of the power to the anonymous people that made this, there is still some choice to that. And it's interesting because one of the key postmodern ideas that will come up later, after Viegla's making works like this, well, I mean, he made them throughout his career, but before, after this one was made, speaks more and more to the idea of giving up artistic control. There was a very critical French writer and philosopher by the name of Roland Barthes. And Barthes wrote a very, very influential essay in 1968 called Death of the Author. And I bring it up here because what's interesting about Barthes' idea was that he wanted to kind of reinvent literary interpretation. You know, so much literary interpretation, so much literary criticism is about writing about and understanding what the artist, the writer, the creator intended, right? And finding that out. And Barthes in this essay said, no, that's not really the case. That becomes secondary. What's most important is what the audience thinks, the meaning they ascribe to the work of art. He wrote in this essay, quote, once the author is gone, the claim to decipher a text becomes quite useless. To give an author to a text is to impose upon that text a stop clause, to furnish it with a final signification, to close the writing. Now, what he means by this is, of course, once he or any critic or even the artist or the writer said, this is what it means, we stop thinking about it, right? We no longer say, well, I think it means this. No, you're wrong. It doesn't mean that, it means this. It's definitive. And what Barthes was talking about was that really should be secondary. And so for him, the death of the author meant, let's not think about what the author means. And for Barthes, truly, there was no definitive meaning. Whatever the audience, all of you, whatever a reader, whatever they brought to a work of art, that had some very important semblance to it. And this is the type of idea that will become absolutely critical for postmodernists, right? And think about how different that is to a certain degree from modernism. Where modernism is all about purity, it's about lack of meaning to a certain degree. Postmodernism really revels in meaning, the proliferation of meaning, the multiplicity of meaning, as well as creation. And so here, you know, there's just a little bit of that as well with the way that Viegla practices, in which he says, I really don't want to be the artist here. The artists are those that made this work, whose names we'll never know. So a little bit of that, and he's foreshadowing what someone like Barthes would write about in just a few years' time as he made this. I bring this up because not only does Barthes' essay have a lot of influence on later artists and art historians and critics and thinkers, particularly from the 1970s on, it also does something very important. It not only devalues what the artist intended, it devalues the critic. Imagine how that must have made Greenberg feel, right? Right? You know? And so, and I can't say, I don't know of a record of him railing against somebody like Barthes, but still. But there is a little bit of a semblance of that. So what I want to do now is just go and talk about one more work and see how these sort of postmodern ideas get, you know, really, really used very, very avidly and very consciously in a work of art. So if you'll follow me upstairs, we have a bit of way to walk, sorry.
Does anyone need the elevator?
Yeah. Okay. Can I go through the double doors over here? Okay. Thank you. Okay.
Very quickly.
Yes.
You're alluding, in essence, to pre-aesthetically, pre-literate art that has been discovered. We don't know what the original artist meant because it was done in a cultural context.
Like prehistoric art.
Yes. And okay. We don't even know the cultural context very well.
Right. Right.
But we make suppositions from our own point of view.
Yes. Yes, certainly.
But you know, each cultural critic is going to make it from his particular cultural point of view.
Well, there is that. I mean, depending on how certain people, thank you, interpret prehistoric art. I mean, one way is if you go from the archaeological standpoint,
yes, yes.
Then you look at, you know, they always say archaeologists love to look at trash.
Well, you know? Yeah, they do.
Yeah, you know, you look at trash, you see what they ate, you
Absolutely.
See what they threw away, and so through that you can then begin to discern certain aspects of how they lived, and then you can make, you know, begin to draw conclusions about, I mean, what function the art and the object served as well. But you're right, I think there is always, I mean, there's a sense of early Paleolithic female figurines,
yes,
right?
Oh, yes, yes.
At various times, they became very popular during the second, third generation feminist movement in the 1960s and 70s,
right.
Because it sort of, for them, was interpreted as reflecting a matriarchal society.
Well, they're projecting all kinds of things. You don't really know the society.
It could be, yeah. I mean, it is unclear.
We suppose what we want to suppose.
Right.
And well, you have a right to do that.
And oh, certainly, yeah.
It's my supposition.
Right.
You just need to own it.
Right, exactly, exactly.
Well, I hear you saying that Greenberg didn't want to, well, he was acting as though he was a universal acclamation. It wasn't just his, it's the way it was.
And that's a great way of putting it. I would say that he would claim that his personal ideas about modernism,
yes.
He felt were universal.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's a great way of putting it. So we can see, for example, in Viegla's work, as it sort of, again, sort of foreshadows unintentionally, you know, ideas of, say, Barthes' Death of the Author, there's a very critical shift that's occurring between modernism and postmodernism at this time. Now, as a term and as a kind of period designation, postmodernism really gets sort of qualified in the 1980s, really around aspects of architecture. But a lot of the kind of, if we think in one very broad way, if postmodernism is a reaction to modernism, it goes all the way back to the 1960s on, right? Pop art was a reaction to Greenberg and modernism. I mean, it was a way of basically saying, you know what, it doesn't have to be formal. Here is a painting of Dick Tracy. You know, I mean, it was, you know, very, very forcefully so. Conceptual art also is very much a reaction to modernism, because whereas modernism really, really focused on, again, that kind of formalist purity, right? Conceptual art in particular is very much about text, was the dominant thing. The underlying idea of a work of art was more important than the visual outcome of it. All of that was absolutely critical in regards to a different mode of practice that today we qualify as sort of postmodern. Also, in very specific ways, there was a lot of sort of conscious deviation from Greenberg formalist modernist ideas through text-based practice, through favoring narratives, through being very open-ended in meaning as well. And all that is evident in this 1987 piece by the Texas native Vernon Fisher. Fisher is fascinating. I mean, as a young artist, he was somebody who painted in a very articulate, consciously abstract, formalist way. But he abandoned it. And I think what's absolutely interesting is that when he sort of, I mean, by his own account, he sort of hit a point where he was just kind of bored with abstraction. And so to just sort of take a break from it, as he felt, he began writing. total polar opposite, right? He simply began writing. He said at first writing was very difficult for him, but he became fascinated by it. He had studied literature. He loves literature. And so for him, writing became sort of the antithesis to, say, abstraction. But slowly, writing took over his artistic practice. And he began making paintings in the very, turn of the 1980s, began making paintings that were first and foremost text-based. And I think that's what's interesting, is that the paintings usually began with the writing first, and the imagery and the outcome would be spurred by what he had written. And what he favored, I mean, he is somebody who is really directly influenced by postmodern theorists and writers like Roland Barthes. He's very interested in the kind of multiplicity of viewpoints, the open-endedness that a lot of postmodern art asks for. So, for example, when you read a text like this one, this painting called Coriolis Effect from 1987, you'll see as you read the text that there's a very clear narrative there. He's fascinated by narrative. And what some scholars call narrativity, right? The kind of referencing of narrative. But it's very open-ended. We don't know the speaker's name. We don't know, we know her gender, but we don't know where she lives. We don't know exactly what's going on. All we know is that she's describing this incredibly scorching hot summer that we've all experienced here in Texas, right? Scorching hot summer. And then the second paragraph is all about her imagined relief from this heat. But what's interesting, and it's something that Fisher does often in his work, is there's a very careful correlation between the text and the image. They're not just meant to be separate or somehow layered upon each other. They intricately overlap. So the title, The Coriolis Effect, references two things. One is, of course, of the many things it is, it's the effect of how water and airflow spins based on the way the Earth spins based on which hemisphere you're in, the northern or the southern hemisphere, right? So typically here in the north, if you can sort of see this, when water goes down a drain, which way does it go? It goes clockwise, right? And supposedly, and I have people here from Australia that can maybe clarify this, if you're in the southern hemisphere, water will go down the drain in the opposite direction, counterclockwise, right? So this spinning effect is something that, of course, he references in this beautiful, striking kind of green neon here in the center, right, in which the spinning shows the Coriolis effect going in a clockwise fashion. But then read the text. The text constantly uses phrasing and words and imagery that correlate with that spinning motion, right? So, for example, the day begins hot and gets hotter. By noon, it's a furnace. Water from twirling lawn sprinklers evaporates in midair. The ground turns to brick. Grass in a time-lapse film withers and curls before the eyes. Down on the desert floor, whirlwinds, a half dozen at a time, generate spontaneously out of the superheated air and twist across the landscape, like children's tops, right? There is this constant sort of punctuation of certain words that constantly bring us back around to this spinning imagery in the center. That's, I mean, very, very conscious, right? But again, we don't know what's going on, so we, the viewer, the audience, the reader, are left to kind of make this association and interpret what's going on in the story, right? Very much like Barthes' Death of the Author. Fisher is doing a very careful balancing act here, right? He wants to make those associations. He wants you to get them. But he leaves it just subtle enough that he's like, here you go. If you get it, great. If you don't, no harm, no foul, right? So there's a little bit of putting the onus on us, the viewer, to make these associations. Now, what I find fascinating about this piece, and he often describes how his paintings, he loves what he calls a high signal-to-noise ratio, right? We walked up to this, and you're probably like, oh, wow, there's a lot going on here. You know, there's neon and text and twigs, and wow, there's just a lot going on. And it's for us to kind of filter through the noise to get to the signal, right? It could be hard to do, but he wants to make sure that we're going to sort of process all that. What I find fascinating, though, is to go back, as I want to do, to this idea of relief. Now, of course, relief is built into this visually, right? We have all these amazing kind of, you know, parched twigs that stick out of the flat surface. I mean, this is about as prominently relief as you can get. You have flat surface, right? The support with the text on it. And then you have these branches coming out of this. And the branches physically remind us of the heat described in the painting, right? You know, we've all picked up those, you know, in the dead of summer, those leafless dead branches that just kind of snap in our hand because it's just so darn hot out. But also, it's a relief effect, right? It extends outward into our physical space in a very three-dimensional way. What I love about this, and you'll have to permit me really dragging out this term relief here, but note the interplay between relief as a technique, a visual technique, and a concept. Because in the second paragraph, it's all about her relief from the heat. To escape the heat, she pictures a house. My mind is a house, she says, with water rushing in. She walks through her mind, opening all the taps. Water flows into the lavatories, into the kitchen sink, through the dishwasher. It pours into the bathtubs and sprays into the showers. My mind is a house, she thinks, and all the water is running through clean and clear. She watches the water spiral slowly, but continuously around a point in ever-decreasing curves. So there is this, and again, I'm not saying, I've never heard Fisher say that was a conscious decision, but it's hard to miss, right? The idea of the overwhelming sense of relief that's imagined in the second paragraph and the visual use of relief here as well, right? All this stuff interacts together. Now note, in a very Barthesian way, I'm giving you the meaning, right? Which is not great, but we're talking about it here. But what I love about this, and for me, sort of the coup de grace, this is something that I feel like Fisher sets up to contradict. By the time that we've looked at the whole thing, we make the associations of certain words with the spinning Coriolis effect, we make the association of relief and relief, right? We get to the very end. Now, before we say anything, where do you think this is taking place?
Australia,
okay. Texas, okay. You know, there is often a sense where we want to associate our own aspects of our lives and where we live. I mean, we may or may not know Fisher's a Texas native, right? But know what happens in the very last sentence. She pictures the rush of water pooling momentarily in basins and bathtubs before swirling counterclockwise down the drains. Counterclockwise. Not spinning in the clockwise fashion we would expect with the Coriolis effect in the northern hemisphere, and accented by the design of the neon, it's the opposite direction. Just as you think you get a handle on it, he throws this one little thing at the end. If you're not paying attention, we'll just glide completely by you. But in fact, at the end, he completely, it's the one word that dismisses the visual image. That's not spinning. That's spinning clockwise, not counterclockwise. And suddenly there is, at the very end, this contradiction of image and text. And suddenly then you're like, well, what have I missed? You know? And then you go back over it, right? And you're trying to, it's meant to be a kind of vague puzzle we're meant to figure out, but there is that one inconsistency at the end. And it's that inconsistency, I think, is one of the amazing aspects about this shift away from modernism, right? Modernism is meant to be, in its own ways, vague, but purely visual. Postmodern art revels in intertextuality, it revels in multiple meanings, it revels in basically intentionally confusing you as well. And in some ways, Fisher does that here. And so I hope that you can sort of see just in these four works how dramatic the shift from kind of modernism and a kind of pure modernism as talked about by Greenberg to a sort of postmodern work like this one here, very consciously postmodern by Vernon Fisher, was between, say, the 1950s and today. And as you walk around the rest of the gallery today as well, think about that. Look at the dates of certain works and look at, say, the process as well, and think about, you know, how these things might correlate. A really interesting example is to look at the Mark Bradford in the next room over there, a very contemporary work. It's from 2010, I believe. And yet he's working in a way that has a lot of associations with Viegla, a lot of associations with kind of formalist practice as well. And there's an interview with him where he talks about how very difficult it was for him to kind of admit he was an abstract painter. You know, like, is this something that, while artists do it today, there is this legacy of just the burden of Greenberg to a certain degree that artists have to work past when they decide to paint in an abstract way. But his painting is also rife with very specific meaning and cultural associations. All that is in there. So just kind of keep this in mind as you walk around and think about the distinction between modernism and postmodernism and the pros and cons of each. So hopefully I've helped elucidate that a little bit today. Thank you all for your time. So I will certainly answer some questions now if you want to. So, thank you. Yes.
Are these twigs roots? Are we underneath?
You know, that's a really good question. I don't know. I've always read them. It would be, you're right. Yeah, I've always read them as kind of twigs themselves, particularly because, I don't know, I see the little bulbs right here, you know, on the end of those twigs. But I don't know, I guess you could read them as roots as well. It's a really interesting question. Yeah, me either.
Something that I was noticing too, looking at the ones that are just on the black, it almost looks like a trompe l'oeil effect.
Yeah.
Have they been painted on, or are they really coming out of me?
Yeah. Well, you know, and it's funny you say that, because the paintings he did just before this that were text-based, he would take a surface and he would take molded letters and paste them to the surface and paint one color over it, and then very carefully sand the letters so they would begin to show up and pop out. But they're relief. I mean, they are protruding from that support. And I love that as well, that his early text-based ones were still this kind of affinity of surface and relief effect and protrusion, and it's not really flat, you know, and things like that. So. Excellent. You're welcome. Thank you all so much. Have a good day.